Now they might start barking, that's all.
That's fine, don't worry, we'll work around it because it's all going to be edited. Right, so it is Tuesday the 4th of August and I'm here with Alan Brigham, who has kindly agreed to talk to me about the Mill Road Depot. And if we could start by confirming your full name, date and place of birth, please.
Alan Brigham, 31st of May 1951, born in Harpenden, Hertfordshire.
And when and how did you come to be living in Cambridge?
I had been, I was 20-something, looking for somewhere to live. I'd been working in Bradford, I'd been travelling around Europe, and I got back and found a letter from an old friend who was living in Cambridge saying, "How are you? And by the way, there's a spare room here. You can have it if you want to." And I thought I'd come to Cambridge for 6 months, save some money. Didn't like East Anglia, didn't like Cambridge.
And when was that, roughly?
Mid-70s. Mm. Mid-70s. So it was chance. You know, I thought I was going to go to live in Scotland. I thought I might go and live in Bristol. I thought I was going to go back to Yorkshire. Wasn't what I planned.
And how and why did you end up at the depot on Mill Road?
Because I wanted some money. I wanted to go to Israel actually next year, and I wanted a job, and I didn't want to go on the dole. So I had a room in Elstree Avenue in Newnham. I walked around Cambridge trying to get jobs, and I'd been working for a sort of shelter supported housing advice centre in Bradford before, but I couldn't get a job anywhere. I couldn't get a sort of job I was interested in.
What sort of things were you going for? Can you remember?
Well, I went for anything that was available. I went for office jobs, I went for manual jobs. I just thought, I want a job, I want some money. I remember now going for a job at an abattoir, but I remember queuing up for the interview and with the smoking of players number 6 and going into the interview with a cigarette in my hand. You wouldn't do that now, would you? But I couldn't get any because my work record wasn't good enough, or I was overqualified. I was overqualified for manual jobs, and anything else, my work record wasn't brilliant. I was walking back to Newnham one day and I met a couple of road sweepers. It must have been autumn, so I met a couple of road sweepers with a great big pile of leaves on the bottom of the road, and I chatted to them and I said, like Cambridge, got somewhere to live, nice place, can't get a job. And they just looked really shocked and they said, "You can't have tried the council." So I said, "Where's the council?" And they gave me directions about how to get to Mill Road, which was beyond my experience at Cambridge in those days. So the next day I walked down Mill Road and I discovered the depot, and I just walked in. I found the man who became my manager. I said, "Have you got a job?" And he sort of looked at me and said, "If you're here tomorrow at 6 o'clock, you've got a job. If you're not, I never want to see you again." And I turned up at 6 o'clock the next morning, which, I mean, I had been a window cleaner at one time before, so I had got up early, and I wasn't anticipating ever having to do it again.
And what can you remember of that first walking into the site? What can you?
Well, it was nothing like it is today. I mean, there were no barriers. The office was where the car park now is, to the right as you go in the site. Roy Pleasance, my manager, the man who became my manager. I mean, I understood later why he looked at me so suspiciously, because I probably had hair down to my, shoulders. I probably had jeans with a. Torn jeans, sort of person I'd never employ now if I was giving somebody a job. And I think the last two people he'd employed had never turned up, and the one before that had turned up and taken a broom and barrow out the depot, and apparently he'd never been seen again, and they picked up his gear from Parker's Piece, so he was sceptical. And I always remember that I started the next morning outside the Corn Exchange, and we had rounds and they were done by pairs, and my colleague, my mate, was a man called Ernie Hart, who I thought was really old at the time. He was probably 50. And he was like, you know, a traditional working man, flat cap, lived in Cambridge all his life. Probably thought, oh no, not another bloody ex-student. But he couldn't have been nicer. You know, he showed me what to do. He chatted to me. He bought me tea on the market when we had our tea break. He'd buy me a cup of tea at the tea stall. And, you know, what makes a job, I think, actually the people you work with is key to it. Ernie was lovely. You know,
what did you learn from him apart from how to sweep?
Well, I learned for a start that my happy-go-lucky, very privileged student background, you know, was immensely privileged. That in those days, I think only 7% of our generation went to university, so which hadn't dawned on me because everybody I knew had been at university. You know, so most people hadn't. I was incredibly lucky to have that freedom. You know, most people left school at 16 or 15 in those days and had been working ever since, and they had to work because they had to pay the bills. And you know, the more I got to know Ernie, you know, not only that, he'd spent 5 years in North Africa having people try to kill him during the war and come back and been immensely grateful to have a job and to have a steady job. He'd started on the highways, I think. His brother also worked on the council. And it was his job, and he relied on it, and it was his income, and the city centre was his patch. And whilst you have a job description telling you what to do, actually his pride came from the fact that his family, his neighbours walked through town, they worked in colleges cleaning, and they would comment on the fact if it wasn't clean. And that actually is important for me to keep it clean too, for his sake as much as for the council's sake.
Keep it clean for him at that point.
Yeah, so it was quite a personal relationship, yeah. Really. And he was a saint. His wife got chronic... she was a cleaner, and she was cycling home one day and somebody stole her handbag out of her bike basket with all the money in it, and I think the shock of that brought on chronic sort of rheumatoid arthritis, the shock, the doctor said. At any rate, he ended up caring for her completely, cooking her meals, cutting her food, and still coming to work at 6 o'clock in the morning and not complaining. And so working with Ernie taught me a lot about people, taught me a lot about how lucky I'd been. But I enjoyed working with him, and I worked with him probably for 10 years till he retired. And he continued buying me tea on the market twice a day for 10 years. And because he was the older man, like my dad, I just took it for granted. And like it was only after he left that it really dawned on me that Ernie was earning the same money as me and he had a family to support and everything else. So I suppose I learned actually, you know, the naivety of youth, isn't it? And you learn these things as you go along.
And did you learn, or did you get the opportunity rather to offer that sort of relationship to someone else in turn? Did you teach people the job in a different way, similar way? Or
I tried to. You'd have people come and go. You would have temporaries who'd come and go, and you try to get them to respect the fact that actually it was important they kept it clean. We used to work task and finish, actually. That was one of the pluses of the job. So you got your work finished, you could go. So we'd start at 6, but we'd probably finish by 1. But the council sort of used that to their advantage, because every time you got on top of an area, they'd just give you more work to do. But that was an incentive, but it was important actually that if somebody came, that actually they realised you've got to do the job properly, or otherwise someone's going to be chasing you up all day long. After Ernie left, I worked for 15 years with Trevor Seeger, who was another older person who was meticulous. His wife worked as a cleaner in Trinity, and like if Petty Curie wasn't clean by the time she walked down in the morning, or her mates, it was her mates, you know what happens, her mates walk down on their work to on the way to work, they see Petty Curie is filthy, they get in the way, oh, Trevor's left it a real mess today, so It's that sort of pressure. You know, he was obsessive about getting all the fag ends up. He'd always come back behind me, chasing me up. I mean, I relied on him to some extent. He would lose his temper. He had the most filthy temper. He'd absolutely shout at me sometimes. So it's difficult. It's a personal relationship. It's sometimes difficult to manage. Mm. It worked. It was really good. You know.
So what did a good day when you were kind of after you'd learnt the job? What did a good day look and feel like? You know, what sort of area did you cover? How?
For a long time, I worked in the city centre. So we'd start, originally, we used to keep our gear behind the Corn Exchange. When the Corn Exchange was still a roller skating rink in those days. So we'd start the morning, 6 o'clock, roll our barrows out. It was booming barrows in those days. And we'd first thing, me and Ernie would do, clean the market. So we'd clean the market and the market coals before the traders set up. And then we'd progress really down all the main streets in front of Bradwell's Court. Even in those days, there'd always be rubbish there. It was where HSBC Bank is today, used to be Wimpy Bar. I think it was about the only takeaway in Cambridge in those days. But there'd always be loads of rubbish there on weekends. But there was no other takeaways. There was a fish and chip shop in King Street, and those were the days when fish and chips used to be wrapped up in paper rather than polystyrene. So there was no polystyrene. There was no McDonald's in Rose Crescent. There's the transformation of the shops, you know, what's now Wetherspoon's Pub, which I think is one of the largest pubs in the country, was a cinema. What's now a restaurant was the Belfast Linen Shop. I suppose what I've seen in 30-odd years is the transformation of the high street.
Yeah. Presumably you have fewer cigarettes now, or late then?
This is jumping forward, but one of the things about the smoking ban is that actually everybody smokes outside on the street. There were no pavement cafes in those days. Some of the pavement cafes today clean up their rubbish, but some of them don't unless they're chased. So there's always fag ends on the pavement. And I'm obsessive about fag ends because they get stuck in the cracks and they just look horrible. But I'm obsessive about all litter, really.
What about chewing gum? That must be another one.
Chewing gum sticks to the pavement. I mean, I've got more used to it, but I've got used to it, but I don't like it. I'm fairly obsessive about clean streets. The place I'm happiest is looking out to sea, because I know there's lots of rubbish under the ways, but you can't see any fag ends and you can't see any bits of paper floating around.
Do you still have those goggles on when you walk the streets of Cambridge?
Sadly, I went to Peterborough to see my brother a couple of weeks ago, and I photographed the rubbish along the side of the road, and I wrote to the council. I actually just finished that. I said, I'm not doing this again. But, yeah, because there were cans stuffed in the hedges, or there were cable boxes with rubbish behind it, and you could tell no one had done the bit. So I suppose, yes, I did get... I'm not a perfect sweeper, but both Ernie and Trevor were, and I suppose that's the key. That's what I learned, actually. They both did a very good job. I wasn't perfect, and I don't think anybody would say I was. But I did know what ought to be done, and I tried. And why have clean streets? Because actually it makes people feel better. Or more to the point, dirty streets make you feel uncomfortable. I think that's... It's almost like a policy document now, isn't it? We want people to be pedestrians. We don't want people to be in their cars. Therefore, they need to feel comfortable. Therefore, they need to have clean streets. They don't want graffiti. They don't actually want chewing gum stuck to the pavements. So we've become far more conscious of the whys of it. But that's always been the reason.
And do you think, as a city like Cambridge, which has so many transient, you know, visitors and so on, do you think there's, because of that, more or less of a pride now than, like you say, when Ernie started, it was a personal pride that he had to keep things clean. Do you think there's a pride in the city as a city that's shown off a lot, or as is it still more important just that it's somewhere where you live permanently? What's the balance?
Well, I think the guys I work with, they've got their patch, and you know, depending on the person, obviously, if you've got a patch on and you feel a sense of ownership for it, then actually it is that sense of ownership, as much as somebody shouting at you and telling you you should do this, is actually the fact that you want to do it. You want a good job done. Actually, you need to make sure the person wants to do it. Some areas are, so if you get outside the centre, some areas are only cleaned periodically, when they used to have their own, you know, patch sweeper, and that can make a difference to how it's cleaned. There's obviously a huge number of people come visit Cambridge, which creates problems. I swept the city centre, and then we went out to contract in for the first time in, I should think, the 1980s, and we mechanised to try to save costs. We mechanised too fast. We had mechanical pavement sweepers, so they were very big and noisy things that went about 3 miles an hour, which doesn't seem fast, but actually 3 miles an hour, if you're stuck behind something going at 3 miles an hour that keeps on going at it, it can hurt you. And one of the guys had an accident. It jammed when it was reversing and kept on reversing and crushed his leg, and eventually had to have his leg amputated. And you know, actually a couple of years later he died as partially a result of that. So there was a lesson about that. Reminded me what must have happened in the 19th century of rapid industrialization. Your competitors are mechanizing, you have to do the same, or your costs go down. But whenever people talk to me about too much health and safety, I think you can't have enough of it, actually, because accidents happen. And Barry lost his leg. Barry died. These things are big and heavy and noisy and dusty, but we won the contract. And we changed our working methods. We changed our working methods quite a few times while I was there. I ended up having a van with a trailer with this machine on the back of it, and me and my mate then covered the whole Arbury area of Cambridge, Arbury, King's Hedges, around to Newnham. Which was interesting contrast. Newnham, which is actually mostly leaves, people in Newnham don't want to roll drop rubbish. They're professional middle class. But leaves are a problem there.
That's a huge area.
And Arbury was completely different. Arbury, for which I always, now, if you mention Arbury to half of Cambridge, you think that they think the moment they cross Gilbert Road, they're going to get mugged, forced to take drugs, or beaten to death by an alcoholic. And you only got to go to Arbury. Yeah, my problem in Arbury was actually grass. There's loads and loads of grassy areas and grass verges, and one bit of paper on a bit of grass really shows up. And certainly when I was doing this in the early 90s, you know, it was full of elderly people who'd moved to Arbury when it was first built, and, you know, very respectable. They'd got they've got homes there, and there were, you know, little pockets of problem areas, Kingsway Flats, flats in Carlton Way. But compared with Bradford, where I'd worked before, you know, Cambridge just doesn't know how lucky it is. And actually, I think Arbury is a nicely built estate. They built it with a shopping mall, they built it with shops, they built it with pubs. It's well planned. So I guess the nature of rubbish is different in different bits of Cambridge, and for me, sweeping different bits of Cambridge and chasing down back alleys or wherever to find what dead cats and whatever's been fly-tipped gave me a feel for the city.
I was going to ask you what turned a good day into a bad day. Presumably finding or having to deal with stuff. And what really got you down on it? What about the work on a day?
Sometimes people say to me, I didn't intend to stay in the job. I thought I was staying for 6 months. One of the reasons I stayed was because I liked it. I liked working with Ernie. I liked the early finish. Didn't like the early start. And then when I came to leave at the end of the first year, I did go to Israel. I wanted 2 months. I was going to go away for 2 months. And my foreman said, well, we'll keep you on the books. You can have your work back because we can get a student to do it over the summer. But I guess by that time he knew I was reliable. So I got 2 months leave of absence. I came back, and after I went to Israel, I got a boat to Cyprus, and then I went to Eastern Turkey, and I remember going up to the Armenian border and then up to the Iranian border. And I just wanted to see what came next. So your plans get diverted. Sometime, I think 1977, I went back. I wanted to go to Afghanistan. Full Lonely Planet. I got a plane to Istanbul and a bus to Tehran and travelled to Afghanistan and then around northern Pakistan. And then I wanted to see the rest of India. So like, okay, they would give me, the real plus was they would give me leave of absence in those days. And there came a point, obviously, when we started contracting, that stopped. But by that point, I was well and truly tied to the job because we got a mortgage. So I also wanted a home. At some point, I thought, well, what do I do? I've got a degree. I thought I would become a history teacher or do something linked with housing. But both of those required more training. I inquired about teacher training and couldn't get training at the time. They said there were too many teachers.
But you did end up working in schools quite a bit, didn't you?
So I ended up doing it, and I suppose I made a decision that I could use the job to actually save enough money for a deposit and actually to take 2 years off retraining. House prices were just going to continue shooting up. So I ended up having three jobs. I used to sweep until 6 till 1:30. I'd go and work in the examination syndicate in the afternoon packing parcels till 5, and then 4 nights a week I'd go and work in the Eagle pub. And I did that for 2 years, and I saved enough money for a deposit on a house, which however many hours you work now, you wouldn't be able to do. But then you got a mortgage, and any house you could buy was one with an outside toilet and needed renovating. So I should think I spent 10 years doing up a house, doing overtime, probably having one day off a fortnight. So the part of the idea of staying in the job was it would give me time to do the things I wanted to do. The reality was actually that I had no time whatsoever and I was tied to it, and actually then you can't leave.
That's the thing about finding that sort of home, buying a home, that's what it does, doesn't it? And you say, when the job was funding travel, that's one thing, but once it starts, it's a bottomless pit.
And by that time, I suppose I was in my late 20s, but like, so things happened. We bought one house, and then we bought this house sometime in the 1980s. And that was the same thing. It needed far more money spending on it than we had. Both of us had two jobs. So you're tied to the job. So,
But you found an outlet for this teaching thing in the work.
Well, I reached a point, I did 10 years working in the Eagle. And I suppose that was one of the things, most of my colleagues, all the road supers, all the dustmen, all had a second job. The money was okay, it was, but you needed to do overtime. Probably with overtime and a second job, you'd be earning whatever the average wage at the time was, but you needed to do the bits. So most people would work a Saturday or a Sunday. You probably only did 4 hours on a Saturday or a Sunday morning, but it still was an awful tie. And you'd have a second job, and my second job was working in the pub, but there came a point where I just couldn't handle getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and finishing work in the pub at midnight. I used to see the tour guides coming into the Eagle courtyard, and I thought maybe I can have a go at that. And until that point, I think, until the point we bought a house, I think I'd always thought I wasn't staying here. And then you slowly realise you don't know people elsewhere. So I became a tour guide, which taught me a lot about Cambridge. So that, in a way, became something I found quite satisfying, what I'd originally intended to do. And because I was a tour guide, a teacher in St. Luke's school asked me to go into St. Luke's and talk to the kids about rubbish, which I remember me and Trevor did. We took the machine in. Kids loved it.
So when would that have been?
And all this wouldn't have been until the late 80s, early 1990s, I should think. And that expanded. I used to do that in my own time, and the council thought it was a good thing to do, and eventually they budgeted for it. So I try to go into every primary school every year to talk about rubbish with kids, which was great because if you're six, you're far more conscious of rubbish. Your face is in it. And also kids play on parks and they're really conscious of rubbish on parks. So they're really responsive. They just blame teenagers for everything. I don't know what happens when they became teachers, but yeah, really responsive. And you can get them to do all sorts of things. You can get them to do to recall the rubbish they've seen, to write newsletters, to count up how many fag ends and how many chip packets. You can get it to fit into the school curriculum. So I enjoyed doing that. So I suppose ironically, part of me ended up by an unpredicted course of doing what I enjoy doing. And what I enjoy doing is trying to encourage people to look at and think about their surroundings, really. I don't think I'm a particularly good historian, and I'm probably not a particularly good environmental educator, but if you can get people to think about their surroundings, either the buildings, the parks, how they got there in the first place, and how they looked after now, you maybe achieve something. I ended up taking all the children into the Guildhall and we'd meet the mayor and we'd do a little mock, do you want to choose how you're going to spend a budget? Do you want to spend it on a park or do you want it on a new classroom? So there's all sorts of things. So that was very satisfying, actually. But people would say to me, they somehow think because I got a nice accent and they probably thought I'd been to university that somehow I was acute eccentric. And actually most of your time you're just thinking about dragging your feet around. You've got up at 5 o'clock, you're going to go off and do another job. Are you going to lose the house because one of these jobs falls by? I mean, at the time I thought if we lost the contract and lose the job, we'd lose the house. Are you going to have enough money for a meal or a holiday? Some people like, especially middle class people, like to romanticise people they think are a bit eccentric. And they think you're walking around writing poetry or philosophy or you enjoy being poor. And actually I get quite cross with those people because actually, no, it's not enjoyable being poor. More to the point, it disrespects the people I work with who are people with the same feelings and emotions as them. They've got the same worries about their aches and pains, their children, their parents. I suppose I've been conscious of it, but I think working, so my background's middle class. I think one of the real problems in this country today is the gap between rich and poor. I worked with people who were not poor, but they were hardworking. I hate that phrase. But respectable, but they grafted. You know, they may not graft for 8 or 9 hours a day. Dustmen might only graft for 6 hours, but God, they knacker themselves. You know, most people wouldn't want to do it. Most people want to pick up rubbish. Lots of people, I get cross because people somehow think it's a dirty job and that makes you dirty. I suppose one of the missions I had in going around schools and also, in the end, I probably became, I think, the best-known person on the city council. You don't want to be on a pedestal on your own. You want people to actually think, well, actually, maybe other people, we shouldn't be judging people just because they've got orange ovals on. You never know.
Do you think you had those sorts of sensibilities about the environment and an understanding of the importance of the environment to how people feel about the way they live? So that's one side, and also the side about we're all people, you know, the sort of shared humanity bit, and that the income and the poverty is different. Did you have those things before you started working for the council and spending your entire time like that, or was that something that developed?
Well, I mean, I was a student in the 1970s when actually politics, I was thinking this weekend, I went to the folk festival and saw Joan Baez and she sang the ballad of Joe Hill. And actually, who sings political ballads like that nowadays? It's all about your own, it's all about personal angst these days, isn't it? And I thought, gosh, it made me realise how things have changed. But I was brought up in a period when I was brought up with the American Civil Rights Movement, with Vietnam. I'm an aging generation, but I think those... I think it's, yeah, I was brought up with the idea of political engagement. And my degree was politics, and my degree was history and politics. And actually, what I learned, I went into politics, to study politics, thinking it was about government, about Labour or Conservative or Liberal Democrat. And what I learned from my professor, a guy called Bernard Crick, who was brilliant, was actually politics is a process, and politics is about how we manage society. But politics is actually about compromising. It's about working together. It's about the fact the distance between the government and the opposition and the House of Parliament is a sword's length. It's about not killing each other. So it's the Aristotelian version of the polis, I suppose. Mm. So I have always been conscious of that. What I learned from my job was the non-academic bit, which is about people. In terms of the place we live in, it made me very conscious that any urban environment is man-made. It didn't just grow. I hate the word grow in history books, although I sometimes use it myself because it's easy, but like, you know, buildings and parks and towns don't grow, they're built. Every bit of land's owned by somebody. We make choices, beautiful buildings, horrible buildings, whether we have a park, whether we don't. Every time I cross Parker's Peace, I think, well, that actually could have been covered in terraces in the 19th century, and how different that would feel. But because it's a man-made city, actually, it's a man-made city, but it's maintained by man. And actually, that's, I guess, my job. I always thought as road sweepers, we were like stagehands. We're the guys that went in, and first thing in the morning, we cleaned the stage in the city centre, and then you guys, the public, the people who work in Cambridge, the tourists, the people that live here, came in, they performed, and part of their performance they left rubbish and would be there behind them picking it up all day. So I think that was our role, really. We were the stagehands maintaining the place for people to perform in. And we were invisible, despite being dressed in the brightest colour possible, yellow and orange. People don't see you, and if they do see you, you're just a council worker, and they don't look at your face. When I started, I used to clean St Edward's Passage, and there was this woman who used to park her bike there always when I was sweeping in it. She never said hello. And when I trained as a guide, I went to a reception in the Guildhall to meet the mayor, and everybody's lined up, kind of shake hands with the mayor. And this woman was in front of me, and she turned around to me and said, hello, and what do you do? And I said, well, you see me every day. But she hadn't seen me, even though I'd seen her. Most people in Cambridge are really friendly, and some people say Cambridge people aren't friendly, and I just think that's rubbish, actually. I think Cambridge people have been very friendly. Part of what I ended up doing as a road... I mean, I sometimes felt... I might have been a stagehand, but actually I sometimes felt like I was walking around with a confession box, that my broom and my barrow and my uniform somehow made people think they could come up and tell me things about their awful family, their terrible children, their relationships. They wouldn't tell somebody they knew, and my job was to listen, really. So you're not the priest, but sometimes people think, and people think because you work for the council, they can blame you for everything. So the unwritten bit of my contract was, if somebody comes up yelling abuse at you, you just have to say thank you very much. What exactly is the problem? And I'll report it to somebody. They don't tell you that when you join the council. So it's a public relations thing.
What about the sort of local government aspect? You're saying that, you know, brought up with sort of activist leanings and so on, and public engagement and change and being an active agent in change and that sort of thing. What did your experience of working for the council on that more councillor, government, political level, how did you participate in that, if at all, and what did you learn from that?
Well, I suppose what my personal development is that actually, initially, I just wanted to travel, I wanted a home, and it was me. And initially I worked with Ernie, and I remember being approached by the union branch secretary, Andrew Murden, at the time of what became known as the Winter of Discontent. I must have just started, I don't know what date that was. And saying, you know, you're coming out on strike, you're joining the union. Like, well, no one had asked me to join the union before. One of the things about my job is I started in town. I was controlled from the depot, but actually your place of work was where you started. So I didn't have much contact with everybody else. And it was a personal relationship with Ernie, and Ernie had fallen out with the union for some reason. I think he'd had to work Saturdays, and it was a typical problem, you know. He'd been expected to work hours which were antisocial, and they cut the amount of money that they gave you as an enhanced rate, and someone hadn't managed it properly. So Ernie didn't go out on strike. Some of our colleagues who were sweeping did. Some of the caretakers in the Corn Exchange did. It was a really tense period. The refuse who did go on strike, you know, people have this idea that you go on strike and you get loads of money from somewhere. You know, they were hungry. They were being fed in Alexwood Hall. It was a bad time. And why did they go on strike? Because they were trying to downgrade their wages, which actually is your standard living. And I remain feeling guilty that I didn't actually go out. But my loyalty was to Ernie. Well, I convinced myself my loyalty was to Ernie because I didn't want to lose money either, probably. And I suppose these are the decisions you make. I was saving to buy a house. I didn't want to lose any money. Ernie was my mate. They all combined to actually, and nobody came and pushed me, so I didn't.
But that's a regret you have now, do you think, or you just think that's...
Well, it happened.
Yeah.
There was a point in time when I did regret it, because when that strike mattered to other people, it was a burning issue, because those that did go on strike and those that did go on strike actually had lost out and had suffered and lost, in fact. And when I became conscious of that, yeah, I felt guilty about it. Now I realise, you know, that's something that happened and you can't go back on it. And because the irony is that I can't even think how it happened. So each section had its own stewards. The guy who was the sweeping shop steward left. He went to Anglia Ruskin, actually, to do a degree in English. And he was there as a mature student.
And this is the GMB.
GMB. And we had an election, and actually somebody else wanted to stand, and we had an election, and it was a show of hands, and I got elected, and it's like a poison chalice. I mean, yeah, and somebody asked me if I'd do it, so I said yes, not really knowing what was involved. And that was a process that actually drew me into how the council worked, and actually beyond just going to work and sweeping the streets. And you had to represent people, and mostly it's about, you know, does their uniform fit, have they got the right size boots, normally it's pretty obvious who's misbehaving and who isn't, quite honestly. It's about representing people fairly in the process. You've got to, you know, it requires having a good relationship with management, actually. But knowing actually you're there. But it's about management respecting your viewpoint as well. It's got to be a two-way process.
And so by the time you were shop steward, was Graham Watts there?
No, Graham Watts hadn't had a job.
No, so you're before that.
Yeah. And then the Conservative government brought in compulsory competitive tendering as a way of really weakening, well, theoretically to make councils more efficient, but in reality was to weaken local authorities' power. I remember we had a huge meeting, all the staff, manual staff, gathered in the garage in the depot, and Mark Todd, who is the Labour leader of the council, but also the leader of the Tory group, Elaine Wheatley, and I think David Howarth, who was leader of the Liberal Democrats, and Geoffrey Datson, who was the chief executive. They're in their suits, and like all these guys are there in their overalls, and most of them have never seen these people before in their lives. And Mark Todd explained that actually jobs are going to have to go out to contract, there might be job losses. Refuse had already been going through a process of getting away from old fashioned wheelie bins. There'd been a lot of discussion and near strikes over going over to plastic bags. Union didn't want plastic bags. I mean, it was due to job losses, but also plastic bags were dangerous because people put glass in them and then they split and people get cut. And somewhere along the line, actually, refuse went over to wheelie bins, which we, I think we went to Peterborough to see. In those days, wheelie bins were new. Most of the country didn't have them. And I think that led to about a third of the workforce losing their job, which meant on refuse, which I wasn't involved with, a lot of negotiation about who was going to go and trying to ensure that people had as good a package as possible, or there was redeployment. And when sweeping came out to go out to contract, John Delderfield, who had been head of the depot, had been replaced by Graham Watts. Graham Watts had been the parks manager. I think I only became aware of this afterwards, but Graham had met Mark. Labour had taken over Cambridge City Council sometime late 70s. It's been traditionally conservative. Mark Todd, who had been a student, I think, at Emmanuel and was worked as a publisher for Longmans, I think, became a councillor. He worked on Coleridge Ward, which had been traditionally conservative, sort of lower middle class conservative. And it was lots of hard work. Him and a team, they knock on doors, they deal with people's questions, and in a way it was New Labour before New Labour, and they won people's confidence. They won control of the council. He and Alison New, who was in charge of the works department, as far as I can remember, she was a teacher at the Manor School, they both met Graham Watts on the parks, and I think they decided that he had the right attitude for going forward into what was a time of change. And Graham became first John Delderfield's deputy, and then both of them had to go for the same job, and Graham got the job. And I did interview John Delderfield just before he retired, and it was quite interesting because, I mean, I think his end goal and Graham's end goal was the same thing, which was actually to retain services in-house. But John would have gone about it a different way. It would have been far more confrontational. His style was more confrontational. His personal politics were conservative. His brother was a conservative councillor in Essex. Graham was more consensual, but and Graham led me into the process. I mean, he didn't know I was from Adam, but I was a shop steward. I'd been having, you know, we had, I don't know, bi-monthly meetings with our managers to discuss issues, they were small. And then suddenly you've got this whole thing about we're going out to contract, it probably means changing how we work, it probably means making redundancies, we've got to cost our prices against others. And Graham took the stewards and the managers, and I remember this, into the office, and we sat down, and on a board he laid out the costs and the prices, and he said, right, you come up with the options. And it's obviously a staple management tool now, but John Delderfield wouldn't have done that. And you then had to look at the budgets, you had to deal with the problem, it became your problem as much as his, even though I'm sure he was pulling the strings behind the scenes. But that made you part of the process. And it's a long answer to your question, but for me, I think we lost about a third of the road sweeping staff, and that as their rep, I had to go in to all the interviews of people with HR. And the process was, it's clearer now. But back then, you know, why shouldn't we make you redundant, if you like, was the question. And people who you've worked with or you don't know that well, but up front they've got bravado, when you sit down in an office or you sit down with them before you go in and you talk about it, why do you need this job? The whole story of their life comes out, because actually money does matter. Money allows you to do or not do things. Also, the hours you work allow you to do or not do things. They change the hours, like you can't do your second job, or somebody plays in a band, or whatever it is. They can't do it. Tears. And I don't know, it's probably only 10 people lost their jobs, but that just gave me insight into people's lives that I could never have got from a book. And I don't think I'd have got anywhere else, because people trust you with things that, and I'm representing them, and that was my job.
So you've got a feel for the sort of impact of changes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was offered by my manager, David Bradford. They brought in a new post, a sort of deputy, can't think what it was called. Deputy supervisor. And David Bradford offered it to me. Like, again, nowadays that would be advertised. He said, but Alan, we'd like you to do this. And I did have a long, hard think about it. And by that time, the union role had grown. We were in the middle of negotiating the first contract. And I suppose, looking back on it, I made a decision, which side are you going to go on? And I said, no, I think I need to stick for now. I never thought that I would be working on the council until I was, 60 or whatever it was. But I did make a decision not to do that. And the job, ironically, went to my best mate, the first person I'd met when I came to Cambridge, and I'd been living in Elterslie Avenue. I had a room there. I saw my old friend. 3 o'clock in the morning on the first night, there was a big bang on the door, stump up the stairs, and this, I don't know, 6'6" guy with a big hat and a long coat and a diminutive little girl standing next to him said, "Hello, I'm Norman. I'm living in the sitting room." I hadn't been told about this. He said, we got the last taxi, to come back from London, we need fiver to pay the taxi driver, can you lend it me? So I gave Norman this £5, and I met him the next morning, and yeah, him and Annie were living in the living room. And for my first few years in Cambridge, he was my mate. I didn't know people. We'd drink together. I got the job on the council. Later, he wanted a job, he got a job on the council too. He bought a house just before we did in Brampton Road, just down the road. His second job was delivering the town crier, so he'd be up delivering free, he'd deliver newspapers after work for the Cambridge News and then do the town crier, be up doing once a week, hours doing that, knackered. But they offered him the job after this deputy job after me, and he took it. And that was a parting of the ways for him and me. So actually my so-called best mate actually became my manager. And again, it's this, what you do changes you. Norman in the end started recommending that we change shift patterns, that our pay be cut, and that we've been made redundant. And I was on the other side. And it could have been different, or maybe not, I don't know, it's your temperament. So I was the shop steward, and eventually I became the branch president. Unions are, the union numbers actually grew, ironically, under Margaret Thatcher, certainly in the depot and public services, because people feel suddenly challenged. I think the public perception of unions is warped by a right-wing press, mm-hmm. but actually most union negotiators, my priority was to try to maintain as many jobs as possible at the best rate of pay possible. And possible is key. You don't want to think you're being taken for a ride. You don't want to think that profits are going off somewhere else and not back to actually the people doing the job. But actually you need the employer to carry on in business. Actually the last thing you want is actually to drive someone into bankruptcy.
Especially when you're working by then on contracts.
Yeah. So it's important to have a relationship. We had a couple of, on street sweeping, I think we had 2 or 3 contracts that we won, but at one point, so when I started it was Monday to Friday, weekend overtime, Saturday half pay, Sunday double pay. For the overtime you come in and you do 4 hours but you get paid for 6, and that's how it was, and that was the incentive. The first thing was to slowly phase out the enhanced rates for weekends. And the second stage was actually getting you to work weekends contractually, which was partially to do with Sunday trading. So Sunday trading changed the amount of rubbish surfing the city centre and bank holidays. So Graham Watts came up with my manager, Jim Edmead, came up with a shift pattern, which was rubbish. I can't even remember the process now, but it meant that a lot of people didn't want to work weekends contractually. Arthur used to drive the litter press, and Arthur Knox, he'd worked on the land all his life. He used to drive those big bits of machinery on the land, and this is the 1980s, I suppose. constant cuts on the land of more mechanisation. He'd lost his job, and he'd done actually exactly what Margaret Thatcher said. You know, he moved into town, he'd moved to where the work was, and he hadn't let his pride get in the way of the fact of taking a job as a road sweeper, which most people consider about the lowest of the low. And he emptied a litter wagon, which is horrible because it was full of wasps and Coca-Cola and melting ice cream and stinky job. And he did it well, and he did it properly, and he did it with pride. He did not want to work weekends, and by this time he was in his 60s, early 60s. And you know, one, he had angina. Secondly, it sounds silly, but he used to go out on Saturday night with his wife and their best friends to the football club for a drink. And on Sunday they'd go to the car boot sale. There used to be big car boot sales in those days out towards the hospital. And that was his pleasure, and that's where he met people. You spend a little bit of money, and your social life, and actually working shifts, working weekends, takes that away from you. And I eventually went on to these, and I realised that actually people stop asking after a while. People stop even asking you if you can come out. You have to plug in to other people's lives. It's not fun, and when I see senior management working weekends contractually, I think it's a good idea. And when I see hospital consultants do it, I think it's a really good idea. But the point about that is actually negotiating a system which actually does suit people. The shift pattern they came up with originally was very confident, didn't. A guy who became my best mate, John McLean, had been the refuse. First of all, health and safety rep, then he became the refuse shop steward. Under Andrew Murden, the GMB had sort of transformed itself from an old-fashioned union where the stewards used to get paid a percentage for the number of members they had. That all went out. You didn't get any payments. You got payment for any costs. Andrew had led the winter of discontent. Andrew then died. He was cycling back home down the A14 and got killed. Peter Aldrich, who was a blacksmith, took over, and Peter really was a lovely bloke, but his line was, these are our rights and we don't back down on them, and that just wasn't suitable for the contracting that came in. John McLean, who had been the refuse shop steward, ended up becoming the branch secretary, so for all of the works department, which was about 300 people. And John was brilliant. He understood negotiation. He could work with the management, but he knew what the bottom line was. And I remember these negotiations about the road sweepers shifts, and I remember him sitting there sometimes just saying nothing. You know, he wasn't going to get involved in the conversation because it wasn't worth having. In the end, management said, you've got to do this. We said no. We had ACAS in, which is like, you know, that's out of the history books, ACAS, Conciliation Service. I remember being there at 10 o'clock at night in Graham Watts' office looking at various options for shift patterns, because, you know, we've got deadlines, it's got to be done. And in the end, John McLean came up with a shift pattern, which was 4 days on and 4 days off, which involved a long day and a short day. So you'd work, one day you'd work 6 till 2, the next day you'd work 6 till 7, the next day you do 6 to 2, then you do 6 to 7. It rolled, but that gave you at least half the weekends in the year off rather than working all weekends. And the money was the same as what you used to get for doing your 5 day a week, 1 day overtime. So actually, there was no significant loss of money. And we won the first contract, I think, on that. But the second contract, they came up, my manager, that was when Jim Edmees came up with this shift pattern of 6 days on and 4 days off. So there were shorter days, but actually 6 days on and 4 days off meant I think you only have 11 weekends in the year when you actually have a Saturday night off that you haven't been working, you don't have to go to work the next day. And we had another, I can't think, we had a ballot, refuse were balloted as well, I think. We nearly went on strike, we had ACAS in again. So it was all quite tense. I mean, it's serious, and look back on it now, it worked out okay, but it needn't have done. And in the end, Jim Edmees' system, we backed down on it, and we went forward with the 4 and 4. And all these things matter to how people feel, and you need to feel some sense. If you feel you're being, if you're in a crap job, you're picking up shit,
mm-hmm.
and your pay's not brilliant, and actually you're being treated like shit, it's not a way to motivate people. But somehow we got through it. People actually felt it was their process. We were very lucky in having John McClane doing the negotiation. And personally, I suppose, my side had been taken by then. And that's where I stayed. But then my role developed. I suppose I took on the school's role and everything else. And I ended up being there till I left the council.
Yeah. And when was that?
About 3 years ago. I mean, yeah, my health, you know, I ended up getting cancer, so it wasn't what I planned at all. But actually, it's made me even more conscious about, well, personally, it made me conscious about what we were fighting for, because my pension entitled me to take ill health early retirement and to get half pay. And if I hadn't, I have no idea what I'd be doing now. I mean, I can do a bit, but my energy just isn't what it was. And I'm pretty sure that I'm pretty sure that in the future, you know, most people won't have pensions. They do, they won't have that bit locked into it. These are all sorts of problems, because when you're elderly and you're ill, the last thing you want to be doing is worrying about money. So I was lucky, in a way. I never earned a fortune. We earned enough to be able to buy a house in Cambridge when prices were still linked to average wages. We were incredibly lucky to do that. I enjoyed, looking back on it now, I enjoyed the job, I enjoyed the physical work. I hadn't realised until I stopped how much I actually missed the physical work. Cleaning the street, it's really satisfying to look back afterwards and see it clean. It's satisfying. I enjoyed the people I worked with. I enjoyed working all over Cambridge. I loved, when I was in the town centre, to go into work in the morning and 6 o'clock to look down King's Parade with nobody around. You could, in the summer you'd see the King's College Chapel getting light. I used to sit Garrow Hostel Lane and look down over the river. You couldn't have a more attractive working environment. I think I really only appreciated it. I went to the hospital the first time and I was off work for 9 months, and I came back and I looked at Cambridge with completely, even though I spent my life telling people to look at Cambridge, you don't do it yourself, and I looked at it with new eyes. God, how lucky. This has been my working environment. You know, my wife now works in a basement office with no daylight. And it does affect, especially, you know, if your job is just a routine job, actually your working conditions. My place of work was great. I enjoyed the work, the people. And of course, the people on the streets, people will come up and talk to you, they chat to you. Gave me a sense of Cambridge. But it doesn't mean that I was going into work thinking, wow. It's hard, it's rainy, on cold days you're cold, you're damp. Going in on a Saturday morning and sweeping in front of the Guildhall, which is just covered in squash chips and tomato ketchup and mayonnaise and vomit, and there's this relation, there's a mathematical formula for how much beer you have, the amount of food you think you ought to eat afterwards, and the amount you actually manage to hold down and don't regurgitate. A little bit of orange carrot and everything, and pink, lurid phlegmo. And it's horrible, yeah, it's not nice. So I wouldn't... And I suppose that's what I'd say to the people that think, oh, he's got a nice little middle-class accent and actually it's a nice job. It's okay, but it's a job. You get paid because you're doing something that needs doing. I wouldn't go out of bed at 5 o'clock now and go and sweep up people's vomit. Pleasure. But I think I was incredibly lucky, actually, to have a city like Cambridge look after, and just the variety of it. I mean, Arbury, Newnham, the town centre.
So bringing it all together, the memories of working for the council at the depot. I know, by the sound of things, you, in terms of percentage of your working time, you didn't spend that much time in the depot. You went in for meetings and that sort of thing. But your memories of the depot and what has gone on there and the changes that have occurred, what do you now, reflecting on it, feel will be lost to the city when the council depot at Mill Road closes?
Well, we had debates about this 20 years ago, so it's not a new thing. Do we sell the depot because it's a site, it's worth money, or do you hang on to it because actually, I don't think local authority should ever sell property, because property is always going to be worth something. It's an asset. You can rent it out, you can do whatever you like with it. But so we've had that debate. What will be lost? Well, and the debate really was, is it better as a works department, for a start, actually? to be based in the core of the city. People come in and start early and go out into the town, certainly for refuse and road sweeping. Is it better to do that than actually be based on the outskirts of the city where you can get a cheaper site, but actually you're coming in with all the traffic, your refuse vehicles are probably holding up the traffic that are coming into town. So there's a logistics thing, actually, is it or is it not the best way of working? And at the moment, the prospect of money because of the public sector cut obviously makes the council think it's worth selling that asset and dealing with the consequences. But what will be lost is what Graham Watts achieved, which was ironically in a period when local government was being quite savagely attacked and when most local authorities in Cambridge actually lost control of their direct works department. And the reason politicians want to keep control of direct work department isn't actually because they like them or they want to do favours to them, it's because actually it gives them more control. The more contracts there are, the more line of lawyers there are, whereas actually if you control your own workforce, you as a councillor can actually probably talk directly to the manager involved about why your street and your ward is dirty. And yes, sometimes it's to do with contractual things, but sometimes actually it's just, let's go and do that. You can get things done. Most local authorities in the East Anglia lost control of a lot of their services. Cambridge was pretty unique in not doing so because Graham was just a very good and successful manager. He won most contracts. The one thing we lost was the swimming pools. But the more contracts you have, the more jobs you have, the more opportunity there is for redeployment if people do lose their jobs. And also what Graham brought in was training opportunities. We brought in apprenticeships. We actually brought in, so it was possible for the son of the guy I worked with, Trevor, so Trevor's son Terry, who was a toilet cleaner, could train up as a building maintenance and, you know, earn more money basically, which is brilliant. So by losing the depot and losing what was known as city services, you lose, or you are in danger of losing, that sense of a unified organisation. That's my feeling, that's my gut feeling. The dustmen are working, moving out to Water Beach, to Amy's Esper. They're still being employed by the council, but actually they are going to feel not part of the city council any longer. Yeah, you lose that. And the thing which has been lost already, when I joined, an awful lot of the sweepers and the refuse staff lived in the Mill Road area. Back in the 1970s, still everybody didn't have a car. People cycled to work, some walked to work. A lot of refuse loaders lived in off Cardam's Lane, Stourbridge Grove, Brooks Road. You know, its proximity still mattered. And there was that close-knit thing where people knew people, people had been to school with people, people's cousins. You know, if you were a refuse driver, you'd try and get your son or your nephew a job on refuse. And actually that was a way of controlling unruly 16-year-olds to some extent. Your uncle's there and you bloody well better do the job right. That's been lost already to some extent. So actually the identification of the people who work in the depot with the surrounding area, there's still a percentage of people living there, but moving everything out to the edge of town will make it not linked to any place at all. I think that's a shame, but it's happened. But I think the biggest shame is actually the risk of losing that sense of cohesion and a very clear sense of belonging to the city council and actually being there together to provide a service. Mm.
Okay. And finally, really, wrapping it up, is there anything we haven't mentioned about, particularly about the depot and your experience of the depot? Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, the buildings that I knew when I first went there aren't there any longer. When I first went to the depot, I mean, it was dangerous to walk through it. There were certainly no yellow lines. There were no pedestrian crossing places. Most of the roads weren't surfaced. The cleansing office, which I did go to, was in the far corner of the what's now the car park. It's been demolished. It was the relic of, I think, some signal box or some 19th century thing that had been on site for. After that, we moved to a prefab. I mean, that's also been demolished. Graham modernised the depot, made it safe to drive in, and actually created proper office facilities. things change. It's more, it was more professional. So I've seen it change, and maybe I noticed that to some extent because I wasn't going in every day. And actually, I suppose I lie. For 10 years, I did start at the depot every day. When I had this van and trailer, I used to go in there every morning, and you'd be standing there at 5:45, checking the water, checking the lights, ready to go, because you want to get out at 6 o'clock as quickly as possible to get things done, to get into town. I used to go into town, clear up the town, and then we'd go out to Arbury. So sitting in the mess hut. When I started the mess hut, you used to be able to get lunch there. You know, Dustin would be back by lunchtime, and you get a good lunch there, and people were based there. So when I worked there, one of the things is actually that thing in the morning when you're all sitting in the mess hut, all those who start early, they're probably sweepers and dustmen. And you're probably sitting in a huddle around the table, and maybe you're just sitting there on your own, coming to terms with the world and having a cup of coffee, or maybe you're just chatting about the world with other people you don't work with, probably. And it is that camaraderie, I suppose, really, isn't it? And I come back to what I said about working with Ernie. I think the personal, the people you work with in a routine job, actually the people you work with and how you do the job are key to actually making a job tolerable or not, plus the pay, they're all important. So the depot has physically changed, and the nature of the relationships in the depot have changed. But and my memories, I suppose, are of meetings with managers, talking about terms and conditions.
Thank you. We're going to end it there, I think. That's okay.